The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning. It is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Donal Kavanagh with you on the show until 12 noon today. You can make contact with us, of course. We've lots to get through, but as we always say, at the very centre of the show are your views, your perspectives and your take on the issues and stories of the day. You can text us or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. Call us on 07491 25000, 00353 749 125000 if you're outside of the dialing area. Shannon taking your calls, Caroline taking your calls as well, of course, and producing as well. You can email comments at highlandradio.com. You can contact us via social media. We're at Highland Radio on X. We're Highland Hub on Facebook. And we're also, of course, broadcasting the show on screen on our Facebook pages and on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, as well. So you can watch the show unfold before your eyes, see our guests on Zoom and in studio, and interact with the show that way as well. Looking at the papers this morning, obviously the front pages of the broadsheets very much looking at the prospects of government formation. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael backbenchers, the Irish Independent tell us, are pushing for a deal with independents ahead of crucial meetings of both parliamentary parties today. Fine Gael TDs are insisting that there will be a rotating Taoiseach. Fianna Fáil with 10 more seats wants more ministries, and that's going to be the horse trading that's going to characterise what happens now before January. Micheál Martin predicting it will be January before we get a government formed, but hope hopefully we will have a government by January. We shouldn't have that 3-4 month lag that we had the last time. Now, of course, obviously the last time negotiations were complicated by the fact that we had the COVID pandemic to deal with, and also the fact that they were looking at a full-blown coalition between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for the first time, something that I said yesterday many of our parents would be absolutely flummoxed by and would never have dreamt in a million years would happen. But that template's been set now. The die's been cast in that regard, so it should be a little more straightforward this time. But you can be guaranteed the horse trading will go on into the wee small hours of the morning, and the speculation will continue constantly. And it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks. Inside of the Irish Independent, an interesting one, David Coleman, the parenting correspondent, why we need to kick our under-16s off social media. I'll be honest, I can't help but wonder, have we got to the point where the smartphone and social media is so ingrained in the lives of younger people now that that would be the ultimate case of trying to put the genie back in the bottle? It's an interesting concept and an interesting article, I have no doubt, but David Coleman there in The Independent looking to get under-16s off social media. Very interesting story on the inside of The Independent. You always know it's Christmas when you hear the strains for the first time. It was Christmas Eve, babe. And then, you know, that's it. It's Christmas. As soon as you've heard Fairy Tale, it's Christmas. But an interview inside the Independent this morning with Victoria Mary Clark, who is Shane McGowan's widow. And she remembers their last festive season together and also says Shane wasn't fussed about Christmas and was very amused by how popular that Fairy Tale of New York actually became. That's on the inside of the Indo. Irish Times this morning, a picture of one of the Irish team on her knees in the Aviva Stadium, head in hands, buried into the grass after losing to Wales last night, not going to the Euros next year, but a great push and a great effort made by the Irish team there. The two Donegal-based players not on the pitch last night, would it have made a difference? Who knows? I'll have to ask the sports team when I get talking to Oisín or Mark later on today. Proposed new Navan-Dublin rail line will cost up to €3 billion. Now, that's an interesting one because, I mean, a rail line between Navan and Dublin, €3 billion. Twin Towns bypass bridge over the Swilly. And I don't want to start this Dublin gets everything and we get nothing sort of, you know, chat again. But it's always interesting to see that, you know, so many stories you get like this where they're looking at a metro, they're looking at a rail line, they're looking at something and the cost is going to be absolutely astronomical. And yet, as we say, I'm Donegal. And, you know, you get caught in traffic in Letterkenny so often these days. It's become, and I don't know what it is. Some people say it's some of these active travel schemes that they're working on at the moment. There's lots of roadworks. A lot of worry, actually, that, I mean, if you do things like take a lane away from the road between the Polestar roundabout and the Creamery roundabout, as they call it, past Ballyrain there, if you take out a lane, at that point, what's that going to do with traffic? I mean, remember what happened when they switched on the traffic lights at the Polestar, and immediately you started seeing traffic backing up right past the Kiltoy area where Unify used to be, right up past Educate Together, and then right up past the Zeus and where Optum used to be, and where TCS is, and is it the Vectra Belting? Is it the name of the car? I can't remember the name. Vective. I think it's Vective is the name. They're right up the Business Park Road there. The traffic started backing up, and can't help but worry if you take a lane out of the road there at Ballyrain opposite the Manterigal Hotel. You take a road out there, you take a lane out there. I mean, what's that going to do with traffic? And we see rail lines in Dublin, €3 billion, and yet still no word on the bridge over the Swinney as part of that wider 10T programme. It's an interesting one. We'll be keeping an eye on it, no doubt. Irish Daily Mail this morning. And again, government formation talks, obviously. This time, Fine Gael and Fine Gael are squabbling over equal billing as Taoiseach. One Fine Gael insider says, if they feel so strongly about changing rotation, go to Sinn Féin. Fianna Fáil TDs are demanding party leader Micheál Martin be given at least 3 years as Taoiseach in any potential new arrangement. And that's the difference. The last time when they were having negotiations, they were almost equal on seats. Now Fianna Fáil is 10 seats ahead. And that is going to make a difference. Inside the Irish Daily Mail this morning, new Greg Wallace bombshell as MasterChef star is accused of inappropriate touching. Now that is something of a major escalation in the story. Because up to now, the claim has been that Greg Wallace made inappropriate comments. And it was one of those things where he and others will say, it was only banter, it was only a joke, it was only banter. But if we're now moving into inappropriate touching, and let's be honest, I mean, in many cases, and let's not in any way minimise it, the idea that banter is absolutely no problem, you can say what you like and, you know, no, you can't say what you like in certain settings, particularly in a work setting and in a professional setting. And, you know, you can't treat your workplace and your work colleagues in the same way that you treat people with whom you're having a pint in a pub. I mean, that's not the way it is. But and really, you shouldn't be treating people you're having a pint with in a pub either if the comments you're making are in any way denigrating or seeking to put people down or make inappropriate comments that make them uncomfortable. However, if we're now moving into claims of groping and inappropriate touching, this is going into a whole new place. And I'm not sure Greg Wallace did himself any favours at all with his social media posts at the weekend. The main stories on the tabloids this morning, the Red Tops all have the same front page story. Malika murder arrest, man held over stabbing of 8-year-old Malika Noor Al-Khalib was stabbed to death in a row when she tried to intervene to protect her mother in what it's now being suggested was a row over a phone. And that's such a horrendous story, such a horrendous story indeed. And Malika being buried today at Ballybeg Cemetery in Waterford. Also Irish Sun, Wallace thrust at me on MasterChef and BBC covered it up. That is a claim from one person, and much more on that. And as I said, this Greg Wallace story, it is growing legs, and I don't think he did any favours to himself whatsoever. So Brave, the headline on the Daily Mirror this morning, a tragic stab death girl, mum to leave hospital to bury daughter who tried to protect her. Looking at the inside of the Mirror this morning, Maura's in a spin over film debut. Maura Higgins has admitted that acting is nerve-wracking, as the first film she ever featured in has won a coveted award. While the Love Island star is more than comfortable participating in reality shows and presenting TV, she said acting is a different ballgame. The Longford model featured in a music-themed comedy called The Spin, which has just won the Best Irish Feature Film Award at the Dublin International Comedy Festival. Also interesting story on the inside, and we were having a discussion yesterday with Dr. Mia Hainsworth. Story here, make domestic abuse and sex crimes a Garda priority. Top cop Harris vows to listen and take on public views. And that's part of the Garda satisfaction survey that we referenced yesterday on our Community Garda slot as well with Grania. Sex offences and domestic abuse are the two issues that people want prioritised, according to that survey that was carried out. At least 90 people said those issues should be the top focus for An Garda Síochána. Human trafficking, assaults, drug offences and illegal weapons also featured prominently in the findings of that survey. And certainly in light of the conversations we had yesterday with Dr. Maria Hainsworth and also some of the national and international stories we've been referencing, that certainly would appear to be no bad thing at all if that happens. Irishman faces jail in Dubai over text is one of the smaller stories on the front of the Irish Daily Star. An Irishman faces jail in Dubai accused of sending threatening emojis to a Belgian man while drunk. Stuart Quinney from Lara in County Wicklow is expected to go in front of a prosecutor. He's been told he could face years in jail after sending a ninja and blood emoji to a man. And we've heard so many stories over the past couple of years about people being jailed in Dubai. And I suppose there's a message there that says, look, you have to be so, so careful when you're in countries that you look at the laws, you look at the traditions, you look at the norms and the expectations, and something that might be laughed off here is not going to be laughed off there, and we need to be so careful when going abroad. And sadly, this gentleman is finding that out the hard way. Still doll up in the air. Martin's in no rush to end a debate on rotating Taoiseach. Inside story of the Daily Star, Micheál Martin again. It's far too early and premature to state whether issues like the rotating Taoiseach arrangement with Fine Gael will remain in place or be changed. I don't propose to get into that, he said. It is far too early. And then the ongoing discussions. And believe you me, it is only starting. You can be absolutely guaranteed that we in the newsroom and the newspapers and the show and national and international media will have a field day over the next however many months, just speculating over who is and who isn't going to be in power and who isn't going to be Taoiseach, and how long will they be Taoiseach, and how many ministers will they get, and how many ministries will the other get, and will it be independents, will it be Labour or the Social Democrats, and how many ministries will they get, and how many juniors will they get. And it's going to be a long, long drawn out process. Of that you can be guaranteed. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. We're here, as I say, until 12 noon. Please do get in touch with the programme, as we said. You can text us 086 60 25000. You can make contact with us via WhatsApp on that same number. Ring us on 074 91 25000 or 00353 74 91 25000 if you're outside of the dialing area. And it's comments at highlandradio.com. In just a few moments, we're going to discuss Alcohol-Related Harm Week, which is taking place at the ATU in Donegal this week. We'll be speaking to Paula Leonard. Paula coming up in just a moment. Before we do, I just want to remind you of our Secret Santa competition in association with Cadbury. Cadbury have 22,000 bars to give away this year to celebrate the return of their Secret Santa promotion. We have two huge hampers of chocolate to give away, plus a €50 voucher every day to be won. If you want to win that, all you have to do is tell us who you would want to surprise with a Secret Santa bar this year. Why do they deserve it? What good reason do you have to surprise someone with a Cadbury Secret Santa bar? Tell us about that person in your life who deserves a bar this year. You could win €50 today. Also going to a draw to win that Cadbury hamper for you and your Secret Santa. And if you want to participate, don't forget, by the way, there's also posters cropping up all over the country with QR codes that you can participate through as well. But you can do so here. And just text in your nomination and why you're nominating them to 086 60 25000. That's 086 60 25000. Send us a text with the name of your nominee and why you're nominating that person to receive that Cadbury Secret Santa bar. Now, as I said, this is Alcohol Harm Related Week at the ATU in Letterkenny. Delighted to say we're joined on line one by no stranger to this programme, Paula Leonard, who is the CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland. Paula, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thanks, Paula. Paula, Alcohol Related Harm Week, it's an important initiative to hold with students in particular. But I can't help but think, you know, you've got a difficult job on your hands to try and have that conversation in a college setting. Am I being unfair?
I think it's really important to understand that actually less of our student population are drinking than were, I suppose, in my day or even 10 years ago. But the concern in relation to sort of student population drinking is that while fewer students are drinking, and they're drinking on fewer occasions, among those that are drinking, they're drinking at very harmful levels. So we're seeing very high-risk drinking occasions. We're seeing, you know, sort of alcohol-related injuries. We're seeing alcohol-related sexual assaults. And bear in mind that alcohol is not a cause of sexual assault, but it does facilitate it, and it does lead to sort of higher rates of harm within those incidents. So I think it's really important to see leadership from Students' Union, from the ATU, to run a range of events across this week, and they fall within a much bigger context. This is European Alcohol Awareness Week, run by Eurocare, which represents us across Europe and works with the Commission and the Health Commission and the European Union. And their focus this year is very much on having health labels introduced on alcoholic drinks, which we will see introduced in Ireland in 2026, making us the first country in the EU to do that. And I mean, the reason for that work at the European Commission is exactly the same reason that we run things, you know, in Donegal, that we see things happening in the ATU, is that there is really little understanding, actually, of the real harm that's associated with alcohol consumption. And the breakthrough message, I suppose, that, you know, our European colleagues are looking for this year is to help people to understand the link between alcohol and seven types of cancer. In particular, I think it's worth noting, you know, one in eight breast cancers in this country are related to alcohol consumption. And that's not something that we talk about a lot. It's not something that people are comfortable thinking about, because we've normalised alcohol use to such a degree that we're very resistant to thinking about, talking about, or accepting the health damage that it's doing to all of us. And there's no safe level of alcohol consumption, unfortunately.
And that is one of the difficulties of this conversation. It's an easier conversation to have in connection with something like smoking cigarettes, because you can make an absolutely definitive statement. Smoking cigarettes is bad. It should not be done under any circumstances. And if you do so, you're putting yourself under risk. And that's now widely accepted by society. With alcohol, it's different in as much as we're told you can absolutely enjoy a pint. You can absolutely enjoy a glass of wine. Now, then the debate becomes what constitutes drinking to excess. And you go down a whole level of debate. Can you say if you drink alcohol, you will put yourself at grave risk of being ill? Because the risk associated with alcohol, I would suggest, is not as serious or as clear cut as the risk associated with something like tobacco.
Oh, I'm going to have to disagree with you because it is 2012 since the International Agency on Cancer defined and identified alcohol as a group one carcinogen. So group one carcinogen basically means that alcohol is in exactly the same risk category for cancer as tobacco and as asbestos. The fact that we don't know that and that we don't think that the evidence is clear cut is really hats off and congratulations to the confusion that has been peddled by the global alcohol industry, by your drink awares, by websites that promote sort of those messages that you've just sort of repeated, is that, you know, a small amount of alcohol may be good for you or may not be health damaging. The World Health Organization is very clear now that unfortunately there is no known safe level of alcohol consumption. So you can reduce your risk significantly by, you know, drinking at lower levels, but there's no risk. And that's very clear in the science. Where it's not clear is in sort of the public narrative. It's not clear in the media. It's not clear in our consciousness. And I suppose that's something that I feel privileged to know and to understand and to know that that's the science. And I think it's really unfair to the public that we have very huge global profit-making corporations who want to confuse that evidence. But whether or not people drink, take a drink, drink at low levels or low risk levels or how much people drink is really not my concern. Allowing people to understand that every alcoholic beverage that we consume has a risk associated with it. That's the message, I suppose, for us, and that's the message across European Alcohol Awareness Week. And that's why we're talking about labels. You know, that should be written on a bottle when somebody goes out and buys one, either in a non-license, you know, in a restaurant or a bar, or it should be in an off-license. And that's all we're looking for. It's like having an ingredients label. People have a right to know.
Are you suggesting then that we should go down the same road that was gone down with cigarettes in terms of larger and larger labels? We've got to the point now where a packet of cigarettes is effectively one big, huge health warning, and maybe the brand might be written on it, but there is nothing else on that packet of cigarettes except a health warning at this point in time.
Yeah.
Should we be looking at doing the same thing on the label of a bottle of beer or a bottle of wine?
Oh, goodness. I think that would be extremely challenging to get over the line in terms of policy. I think there are very, you know, large corporations that would oppose that. I think there's lots of reasons. You know, I think people should be able to go in and choose and, you know, look at labels and look at what types of wine that they like or don't like or want to purchase for themselves or for others. But I think it's really important that there is visible labelling that tells you, A, what's in your drink, and B, what potential health harms that that might do for you. So we're going to see, you know, health labelling in relation to the risk that alcohol poses during pregnancy. We're going to see labelling in relation to, you know, content in your alcoholic drinks. And we're going to see labelling in relation to alcohol and cancer risk. And those will be rotated. And I suppose over the coming years, we will know then what impact that's had on consumption patterns within the population.
Are there specific cancers with which alcohol is associated and is a risk factor in terms of, and by that I'm saying, if you look at, say, tobacco use, again, you can say lung cancer, throat cancer, cancers of the thorax, and then illnesses of the respiratory system, COPD. There's a very clear line where you can say that the effect of tobacco smoke is X, Y, and Z, and that causes 1, 2, and 3. Are there equivalents in terms of identifying where the risk levels are with alcohol?
There are. There is very good research right now. There's also improving research. There's also ongoing stuff. But the European Beating Cancer Plan has published on that quite widely within the last year, and they're basically saying, look, there are 7 types of cancer that we can definitively and scientifically say are associated with alcohol consumption. That does include, you know, mouth, throat, neck, breast in particular, stomach. So a lot of the ones that, if you think about, you know, where alcohol physically touches, you know, your system as you drink it, we also know in particular, I suppose as a woman, I'm really conscious that it's important to have conversations with women. At the European level, they're saying that 1 in 10 breast cancers are associated with alcohol. Unfortunately, in Ireland, because we have a sort of a binging pattern of alcohol consumption, our figure is estimated to be 1 in 8 breast cancers are associated with alcohol consumption. And, you know, the European research will do that right across those 7 types of cancer. It has evidence in relation to all of those. I think they're really hard conversations. I think it's hard for somebody, you know, sitting at home listening to the radio this morning to accept that, because it's not something that we've talked about enough or known about enough, and we're very resistant to accepting it. And I think that whether or not you make a choice to drink alcohol as part of, you know, the decisions that you make in your life as an adult, I think that we should at least know the harms that are associated with it. And I think the same goes for tobacco. And the same should go for ultra-processed food. We should know what the risks are when we consume products or when we consume food or drink or smoke.
Is your message to students then at an event like Alcohol-Related Harm Week at the ATU, is your message, please consider stopping drinking completely?
I think our message has always been and continues to be that people have a right to know. People have a right to know that alcohol is a neurotoxin that has an impact on your brain, that 1 in 10 early dementias are related to alcohol. People should know that alcohol is, you know, a significant risk to brain development when it's drank during the teenage years. People should know that it's a risk during pregnancy and that it can lead to, you know, lifelong preventable intellectual disability in children. It is the leading cause of preventable intellectual disability on the planet. So these are all things I think people have a right to know. I think it's up then to governments and legislators to say, well, you know, this is what we are suggesting that you do. That's why they have low risk drinking guidelines. But for us as a charity and as advocates, We very much fall strongly on the side of you have a right to be informed as a consumer, and what decision you make beyond that is up to yourself.
And what sort of response and reaction have you been getting from the students at the ATU?
I think it's really important to highlight that Atlantic Technological University, in its last, when it was last named, they were one of 22 universities, third level institutions at the time, who had signed up to the REACT program, and REACT stands for Reducing Excessive Alcohol Consumption in the Third Level. Quite the mouthful. But basically it meant that they were paying attention to and were concerned about alcohol consumption, excessive, harmful alcohol consumption among student population, and that they wanted to look at sort of policies and procedures and initiatives within the student population and within the ATU at a, you know, at a management level, and sort of better management, better awareness, better education, looking at, you know, not serving alcoholic drinks at events on campus, all of those sorts of things. So they have been committed to sort of that harm reduction journey for quite a time, and I think it's entirely appropriate. They don't need people like me waving fingers at them. I think people need to have the conversations within the student body, and I think it's great to see leadership from the students' union.
Before we finish, two comments that have just come in. One comment: legal poisons are the ones that do the most damage, but they're taxed and socially endorsed. The other says, morning, Donald. Here we go again with these experts. Not so long ago, they told the people that glass of red wine was good for your health. I've lost faith in experts, just like I've lost faith in the government. Just two different perspectives. And
I suppose, just on that, I think that's really, you know, that's really important. And this is exactly what I was saying about people are really resistant to the message. Experts have never said, you know, a glass of wine is good for you. There has been research is one of the areas where the alcohol industry has really infiltrated. It has supported, it has funded research to support their position, which is, you know, that alcohol consumption isn't as harmful as the independent voice of public health would tell you. And I'm just here to share what the science is telling people. And the science is telling people that, unfortunately, there is no safe level of alcohol consumption, and all alcohol comes with a risk to your mental health, a risk to your physical health. And we can limit that and we can reduce our risk, but we need to be informed by the science.
Absolute food for thought. Paula Leonard, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a million, Donal. Have
you,
a lovely
Paula.
Day.
You too. That's Paula Leonard there. She's the CEO of the Alcohol Forum. Let's look at one or two comments before we go to a break. And Connor says, my favourite takeaway moment of your excellent election coverage was when Donal was interviewing Niall Blaney toward the end of day two. I always enjoyed Donal's ability to process new information and present it to us in an easy to understand way. Niall was presenting his mathematical analysis of the transfers in a neo-Darwin manner, in that the votes didn't originate with the right voters or they'd be dead by the time they went around the houses and onto the next candidate. Boy, did I enjoy it when Donal just said, after listening to Niall, my head hurts. And it was quite honest. My head did hurt at that point, to be honest. I hope Donald's head's well rested now. It most certainly is. Cotter says, thanks for your professionalism and entertaining presentation of the count. And thank you indeed, Sarah. I mean, that was a job that was done by a team of people. And you saw Greg and you saw myself. And Greg did a stunning and amazing job. I have to say, I take my hat off to anyone who can sustain that for as long as Greg did. I mean, it was a mammoth task. And Greg took it on admirably. Greg did wonderfully. All the online stuff was done by Michaela. I did a little bit more on air than Michaela did, and the reason for that was Michaela was doing stunning work online. All the coverage online, all the photographs, all the online work, that was all done by Michaela. Technically, everything was held together by Joe Dex, and Joe did a fantastic job. You probably never saw Joe at any point or barely heard Joe's name mentioned. Without Joe, it wouldn't have happened. We had Shannon and Caroline there doing Trojan work in terms of sourcing materials and supporting the team. Everyone that was there, and I know it's become one of the sort of cliches, but it is absolutely true. What happened that weekend happened because a team of people worked together. Some of the team you saw and heard more than others, but without every single one of those team members, the coverage wouldn't have been what it was, and I'm proud to have been associated with it. It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Just want to mention there's an invited lecture suitable for public and medical practitioners, When the Doctor Becomes the Patient, My Successful Battle with Breast Cancer. It's being given by Dr. Sinead Hanley, who's a breast radiologist in Adelaide. Now, there's a change to the venue if you've intended going to this. It's now taking place in the large conference room at Letterkenny University Hospital. It's taking place tomorrow evening from 7 until 8, When the Doctor Becomes the Patient, My Successful Battle with Breast Cancer by Dr. Sinead Hanley, breast radiologist, Adelaide. It's a change of venue, so if you're going to that lecture tomorrow, it's now taking place at the large conference room at Letterkenny University Hospital. Now, we have a message in from a listener, and I just want to read this to you before getting a response from the INTO. I just wanted to highlight an issue that's really frustrating. My partner is a newly qualified teacher and has been subbing for the past 6 weeks in primary schools, but has received no pay from the Department of Education. She's applied for her teaching council number, but they told her this could take 8 weeks. 8 weeks to generate a number. It's now the mouth of Christmas and she will have to accept payment as an unqualified teacher with no teaching council number, even though she is a fully qualified primary school teacher, and will miss out on hundreds if not thousands of euro because the Department of Education are so slow at issuing a teaching council number. Now, we're joined on Zoom this morning by John Boyle, who is the General Secretary of the Irish National Teachers Organisation. John, good morning.
How are you doing, John? Good morning to you too.
Good morning, John. John, you've heard this the comment from our listener, and I'm sure this is something you've heard before. Effectively, a qualified teacher is teaching but can't get paid properly because they haven't yet been given a number.
Yeah, Don, that story certainly caught my imagination, captured my attention yesterday when I heard about it first. And it is very disconcerting for us in INTO when we know that there's 3,000 vacancies this year in primary schools. And we also know that there's nearly 800 unqualified people working in classrooms when we did our survey back nearly 6 weeks ago now. I suppose, yeah, you asked, did I hear of it before? I used to hear a lot more about this, Donald. We had a concerted effort with the Teaching Council to try to improve their processes. And this one here, I suppose we don't normally comment on individual cases, but I certainly would love to be able to help the listener, and maybe they might be able to contact me afterwards, because every teacher who's qualified deserves to be in a school, and certainly there's plenty of vacancies at the moment, as I said. But it is a wee bit of an outlier in the sense that if you qualify in Ireland, there's a fairly seamless process for registering with the Teaching Council. And I think rather than this being a payroll issue, it's more a Teaching Council issue that the teacher hasn't received the registration yet. And then when you receive your registration, it's at that point that the law of the land allows you to be paid as a teacher. So the big problem here for this listener is that his partner is not, or her partner's not, registered yet. And 8 weeks would normally be the maximum length of time for somebody who qualified in Ireland. But the seamlessness is that the College of Education, where the person studied, starts engaging with the Teaching Council normally around the month of May. And then when the results come through in July, the Teaching Council gets those across in one bulk from the college. And then that gives ample time for the teacher to be registered for the jobs market before the schools open at the end of August. Now, schools have been open for 12 or 13 weeks at this stage. So it is galling when somebody hasn't been able to get registration. But maybe there could be individual circumstances. I'm not really sure. The big issue tends to be more so, Donald, with payroll. I remember Joe McHugh, when he was minister in 2019, went around a number of schools in Donegal and into staff rooms, and there was a lot of concern about the difficulty in contacting department payroll, feeling generally that they were understaffed and under-resourced. And that hasn't really changed very much. You know, there are certain pinch points in the year, particularly at the beginning of September, when all the new teachers are coming on board and the other teachers have come off payroll to retire. There certainly can be a pinch point there, but we do hear a lot of frustration from our own members when they're coming back from overseas, or where they're moving from Northern Ireland, or whether they're basically mm-hmm. just been appointed to a temporary position maybe in the month of August, and it can take them up to 8 weeks to get their pay. So that's certainly not acceptable. And the Department of Education is doing a big kind of a engagement with stakeholders at the moment, a big survey that they completed last week. And in that case there, we encouraged all our members to send complaints into the department through the survey that the services that they're getting from payroll in particular are not good enough.
Yeah, and indeed, the fully, I mean, obviously, I read you an extract from a longer communication, and reading down that email, the next paragraph does say that the teacher in question has also contacted the Department of Education and various other payroll offices, but has got nowhere. They say the teacher's payroll office only opens for 2 days every second week, Thursday and Friday, from 9 until 1. And they say that's ridiculous when you consider the people they're employed to help are teaching children in school during those hours. So the office is only open while teachers are in classrooms, and that only 2 days a week for about 4 hours.
I know, and that's a point that we've made repeatedly to the department, and even back as far as 2019 when the Donegal minister was in power. And certainly they're much more efficient if they're contacted by email. And if you're in a school, usually the school principal will know which person in the payroll section deals with that particular school. And in that case, you can actually email that person directly and you might get a much quicker response. Yeah. But it's not acceptable that the public officer, the office that teachers would contact, is only open for a very, very short period every week by telephone. And not everybody has access to email as quickly, I suppose, particularly teachers who are subbing. You know, they're not necessarily attached to a base school. And in that case, they mightn't have the detail as to who directly to good contact. So that's why we've asked all our members to put in very, very strong feedback to the department in the survey. And we got a message yesterday that they were inundated with responses to the survey. So hopefully that will bring about some improvements. But, I mean, the overall situation here in Donal as well can't be forgotten, that this is one case here where we're short a teacher who should be getting paid at the fully qualified rate. She's a fully qualified teacher. But we have nearly 800 people unqualified. We have nearly 3,000 vacancies. And the new government is coming in now, and we published a manifesto ourselves very, very soon before the general election. Every party got it. And we did get certain commitments from parties that they're going to try and improve the processes with the department, but particularly to try to improve the teacher supply crisis, try to make the profession more attractive. And any young Irish teacher that I hear that's here and is keen to work or keen to return to the country, we in this union certainly are doing our very, very best to make sure that they can get back here, get a job, a full-time job, get up the payroll, and get working in front of the children who have been left without teachers for so long. And that's obviously a national scandal. And in this case here, this is a teacher that we need in the system as quickly as possible. And if I can give any help, maybe offline, I'd be happy to do
so. Well, what we'll do, John, is we'll pass your details on to the person that sent in the original message to us, and we'll get the two of you in touch, and hopefully a resolution will be found to this particular one. John, thanks very much indeed for sharing that with us. Hopefully, as you said, this is an outlier, and obviously we want to be fair to the Teacher Council and to the Department of Education and so on, but I mean, you know, the sooner this is resolved, the sooner we have another fully qualified teacher teaching children in a classroom for a fair and commensurate wage. And, well, it might be debatable by your union how fair and commensurate it is, but hopefully we'll have a fully qualified teacher in a classroom where she belongs, doing her job and getting paid the required rate. John, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome, Donal.
Thank you, John. That's John Boyle there, a Donegal man, of course, but also the INTO. Now, let's move on to... before we go to a break, I want to go very briefly to the second competition, because we're being so good to you. Christmas, obviously, is coming. So, you know, it's a time of generosity. And I want to remind you of The competition we're running in conjunction with the Silver Tassie Hotel and Seascape Spa. We're giving you the chance to win their Pamper Me Please package. It's worth €130. A luxurious 2.5 hour spa package includes an aromatic steam session and cocoon room, a hot towel, foot and back cleanse, a stress relieving back massage, a Yonka facial with face and scalp massage, a pressure point foot massage and snooze room relaxation time with refreshments. And who couldn't be doing with that after a hard week's work? You can participate in that competition by answering a very simple question. The question is, which Christmas song mentions a one-horse open sleigh? Is it Jingle Bells or White Christmas? Text or WhatsApp your answer, name and address to 086 60 25000. We're going to go to Zoom and speak to Dr. Charles Omani, who is a lecturer in law at the Galway University School of Law. Charles, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
A study commissioned by the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission has found that many disabled people face barrier layered upon barrier in trying to access their legal rights. Now, anecdotally, we are told things are improving all the time. From the findings of this particular survey, it would suggest they're not moving quickly enough.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think if you look back to the 90s, you had a report called the Commission on the Status of Persons with Disabilities, and that made recommendations to improve access to justice for disabled people. And a lot has happened since then. We've had the Disability Act, we've had the Employment Equality Acts, we've had the Equal Status Act in terms of access to goods and services, and disability is a discriminatory ground under that. But this research was actually asked for by disabled people. The Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission have a disability advisory committee of 13 disabled people and who are activists and advocates. And they asked for this research because in their own lived experience, they had found lots of barriers to claiming their rights and to be treated equally and included in society. So this research, it's quite a long piece of research. It's 250 pages. And it importantly looked at all of the evidence, the law, the policy, the research, but then it also interviewed people working in the justice system, criminal and civil, and also disabled people to get their perspectives. And it found that there was a huge amount of barriers facing people in accessing the justice system. There was 30 different themes that emerged in the research. And I can talk to a couple of the key points if you want. But really, I suppose the main finding from the research is that the people that have the greatest legal need in terms of challenging discrimination, accessing services, they have the greatest amounts of obstacles in accessing the justice system.
In terms of the failures, is this a failure of law or is this a failure of structure? As in, do we need new laws to actually uphold these rights, or is it a matter of taking the laws and provisions that are there and actually applying them on the ground?
There's actually a lot of law, there's a lot of policy, but I think implementation is very important, and there is new laws that are needed, the reform of laws. But I'll give you an example around resources. For example, we do have for many years a national advocacy service, but it's not put on a statutory basis, so there isn't a right to have an advocate. So we have lots of people, say, for example, across Donegal, there's residential disability services. There are lots of people living in residential disability services, and they're subject to a lot of restrictions in their own homes in terms of restricted access to the community, restrictions in their own home access to kitchens, locked doors. And there's no real oversight. There's inspection from HECWEB, but there's no oversight. And a lot of those people don't have access to an advocate. So people should have an independent advocate. And that goes across lots of different areas. So that's one area where this could be addressed, to actually increase the funding for the national advocacy service and put it on a statutory basis, so have it in law that people have a right of access. And then the other area that I kind of point up as well is around legal aid. So we have, you know, well-funded criminal legal aid. So if you're accused of very serious criminal offences or criminal offences, you can have access to lawyers. But let's say, for example, you're a disabled person and you're discriminated against in accessing education, or you're discriminated against in employment. You're entitled to take a case to the Workplace Relations Commission, but you don't get provision for a solicitor or a barrister to help you argue your case. And if you're going up against an employer, for example, or a service provider that's discriminated, they will have legal representation, or they'll have an employer will have IBEC representation. So there's an inequality of arms when you are actually challenging discrimination, and that's something that needs to be addressed.
And clearly it would appear from that point of view, and in one way that's anticipated my next question, because I was going to say someone in that situation may feel vulnerable, they may feel I won't say threatened, intimidated perhaps is a better word. Not necessarily that it's being deliberately done to them, but that's the way they feel as a result of, as you say, that inequality of arms. And it may make people either drop a case or perhaps even worse, having heard of other people's experience, may actually make them think, no, I won't take a case at all.
And that's it. And I suppose I should say as well, you really want to be taking a case as a last resort. It's very expensive. It's very emotionally taxing. It's very upsetting to take a case, and it's stressful. And that's why there's another set of recommendations then around awareness raising. And particularly for people in the justice system, in the court service, in the various different bodies that are involved in the administration of justice, that there is more training for people and more awareness raising, because, there is that disincentive to challenge when you experience discrimination because of the barriers and the difficulty in taking a case.
It's an interesting and fascinating subject, Charles, and we'll be keeping a close look on this, because obviously we want to ensure that anyone that needs recourse to law or anyone that needs recourse to something like the WRC is given all the supports that they need. Obviously this study is highlighting this. Are you getting the sense from people you know in the legal profession that, you know, attention is going to be paid to this, and more importantly, action is going to be taken on the basis of it?
There will be. So Ireland, and I suppose one of the reasons this has been given attention is because Ireland has signed and ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We were the last actually EU member state to do that. We did that in 2018. And then recently as well, at the end of last month, we finally, Ireland finally ratified the optional protocol. And the optional protocol allows people to complain directly to the UN Committee in Geneva if they feel their rights have been infringed, or they've been discriminated against, if they've exhausted their domestic remedies, or if they've taken a case and they've lost, or it's too difficult to take a case, or if it takes too long, you can potentially make a complaint to the committee in Geneva. So actually Ireland is going to enter into a reporting cycle. So Ireland's record across all of disability law and policy is going to be scrutinised in the next year or two in Geneva. And that gives an opportunity for disabled people, disabled people's organisations, NGOs, the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission to call out failures and to make identify areas where there could be improvements. So there is a lot of scrutiny, and the government, and if you look at the manifestos from the recent general election, there is a commitment across different aspects of disability. So it is an area where we should see development and increased resources in lots of different spaces.
Dr. Charles O'Mahony, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. And that's Dr. Charles O'Mahony, their lecturer at the University of Galway's School of Law.